Welcome to Guerrilla Radio. We're pre-recording this on March 31st. Those praying the U.S. presidential election would finally end already may have found a receptive ear above or wherever these kinds of entreaties are heard. But as the old saw warns, they might want now to have more carefully wished. With the Democratic Party postponing 14 state primaries, there are now growing calls for both parties to cancel national conventions and end campaign appearances. It would be an unprecedented move that would affect the way democracy is done in America for this election year and perhaps beyond 2022. Alan Hirsch is an instructor in the humanities and chair of the Justice and Law Studies program at Williams College and author of numerous works of legal scholarship and many books, including For the People, What the Constitution Really Says About Your Rights, Impeaching the President, Past, Present, and Future, and the just released A Short History of Presidential Election Crises and How to Prevent the Next One. His articles appear at, among other places, The Washington Post, LA Times, Newsday, and Common Dreams, where I found his recent article, Is America Prepared for a Presidential Election Crisis? Hirsch asks, what if COVID-19 or some other external forces drive November's poll into the shadows, or worse, onto the internet? Alan Hirsch in the first half. And even before the latest crisis, the news cycle was moving way too fast to follow. Every day, miles of newsprint and incomprehensible amounts of whatever online journalism is measured in spun and roiled, confounding the senses of Jane and Joe Blow. Fake or not, it seems there's simply just too much news to choose from. But can we citizens afford to take our eye off the direction in which our society is careening? Taylor Skolan is a publisher and co-founder of Passage, the new Canadian publication offering left-wing perspectives on political, economic, and culture. I'm confident he would say hell no. Taylor Skolan and Canada amidst the media maelstrom in the second half, and longtime Guerrilla Radio contributor Janine Bancroft will be here at the bottom of the hour with the Left Coast Events bulletin of some of the good things to be gotten up to in and around our town in the coming week. Yes, there are still things to be done, but first, Alan Hirsch and American Election Crises, Past, Present, and Prescient. Welcome to the program, Alan.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's my great pleasure, of course. Now, Alan, before we get to the presidential election, we must first transit the primaries. Is America prepared for a primaries elections crisis?
Fortunately, the virus hit after both parties more or less picked their nominees. Of course, there never was a Republican race. President Trump is going to be renominated, obviously, by the Republican Party. And Joe Biden more or less put Bernie Sanders and the rest of the field away before the problem arose. So the primaries are being postponed, in some cases maybe canceled. But fortunately, that doesn't really matter at this point.
So it couldn't matter to Biden and Bernie Sanders. But for those voters in the United States where they see, especially in states that are affected by the Electoral College, which takes their choice apparently away from them, the primaries are their only choice, their only chance, rather, to have their voices heard. Well, do you think that it might have an effect on the turnout of the general election if electors in those states whose primaries are delayed so far that their states may lose their delegates or lose a portion of their delegates? Will they feel they've been iced out of the process and then therefore don't really feel like participating in the general election at all?
I doubt it. And the reason I say that is America has this unusual system of nominating its candidates in any event. This long drawn out primary process, Iowa and New Hampshire always started off. And usually by the time you get through Super Tuesday, it's all over. And therefore, these states, which right now are having their primaries postponed, they're used to not mattering very much, sad to say. So in this case, there's even maybe a better excuse for them not mattering than simply the way the calendar falls. So I think, as I say, the people of many states in the United States, it's nothing new for their primary vote not to count. So I think they'll be ready for the general election.
Well, now you say in your article that you outline that the presidential election crises are not as novel as this virus shutting down a presidential primary. They've happened time and again over the years, and this is a product, you say, of the process itself. Can you explain a little bit about the past crises in American political life and how they are pertinent today?
Right. So American elections worked out just fine for two elections in which George Washington was unanimously acclaimed president. And everything started going downhill after that. So in 1796, without going into the weeds, a quirk in the Electoral College, which of course is our bizarre system, led to John Adams being president and Thomas Jefferson, basically his political opponent, the opposite presidential candidate, ending up his vice president. And in a weird reaction to that, to make sure that didn't happen again, Jefferson's party, the Republicans, in those days, I don't want to get too much into the weeds right now. We don't have time. It's in the book, though. I spell it all out. In those days, electors were given two votes, both for president. And the person who finished first became president, the runner-up vice president. So in 1800, the Republicans, Jefferson's party, they weren't taking any chances on having what happened in 1796 happen again. So all the electors voted for both Jefferson and his running mate, Aaron Burr, which weirdly produced a tie between the president-elect, who he should have been, and the vice president-elect. And that didn't get sorted out for many weeks and 36 ballots in the House of Representatives. That was the first true election crisis in America. The founders responded with the 12th Amendment to the Constitution, which solved that problem. Never again would you get a tie between a presidential candidate and his running mate, but it didn't solve many other problems. And by 1824, just a few decades later, there was no candidate who received enough votes to become the president. So the thing was thrown into the House of Representatives again. It was only resolved through a backroom deal that left many people feeling embittered. Fortunately, we went a half century before the next crisis, which was in 1876, and more than another century before the next one, which was the crazy election of 2000. But the scary thing is, those are the four overt presidential crises where basically the day after the election, we woke up, didn't know who was president, and didn't have a very reliable, fair means of figuring out who was president. But we've had many other close calls, including 2016. And we are headed for a very good chance, another crisis in 2020. That was true before the virus came along. I wrote my book before the virus came along. So obviously that doesn't help. But even without that, we know there are hackers targeting the election. And we have simply, amazingly, in my mind, not prepared ourselves for the next presidential election crisis, even though we have had several of them and many other close calls.
Well, of course, the 2016 has been with us for the last 3 years. Was the proven interference by Russian actors, was that really so significant that it affected the trajectory of the election?
So we don't really know. The interference that has been documented is through Facebook and the spreading of misinformation and the email hacking and then the release of emails embarrassing to Hillary Clinton. In such a close election, small things like that could be the difference, but that's not the real concern, or at least that's a small concern compared to what we know hackers are trying to do and have the capacity to do, which is converting votes from one candidate to another. There's no evidence that that happened in 2016. There is lots of evidence that that could happen in 2020, and we're absolutely unprepared for it.
Well, and this is where we get really into the interesting aspect of this recent pandemic, where it seems logically the next step to canceling an election or postponing a general election outright would be to have some form of online voting where people don't have to congregate and risk infection. And this is really one of the main vectors of hanky-panky, so to speak.
Right. So we're moving towards voting by mail, which a few states already have as their primary vehicle for voting. Many other states have it as an option, where an absentee ballot, anyone can get it. No excuse absentee voting, it's called. And as you indicate, the mail-in system has its own set of problems. It is susceptible to fraud. So is on-site voting. So there's no foolproof mechanism of vote casting and vote tabulation. What I would like to see put in place is a reliable means of resolving such controversies as typically arise in a very close election. When there are allegations of fraud, there are allegations of voter suppression, there are issues with voter tabulation. Now, when that happens and we wake up not knowing who won because it's so close and there's so many allegations of difficulties, we have no means of resolving it. It's helter-skelter. People rush to the courts, state courts, federal courts. The politicians get involved, and there's no fair, reliable means of determining who won.
But there's always the Electoral College. I mean, there was never an election, at least in my lifetime, that was more helter-skelter or ran to the courts than the 2000 Gore v. Bush election, where the tabulation process proved a big factor. We can all remember those butterfly tabs that caused so much trouble. Would it be, Alan, I mean, is it possible that we could just go back to a simple paper and pencil method here?
So a couple of things. The Electoral College is the problem. It's not the solution. And regardless of how we cast ballots, whether it's by paper or electronically, by mail, however you do it, there will always be potential fraud, difficulties counting, logistical issues. That's always a risk. But the Electoral College magnifies that risk tremendously because it produces squeaker elections. It makes elections very close, which otherwise wouldn't be. Perfect example is 2000. That election came down to the state of Florida, where millions of votes were cast and only the candidates were separated by only a few hundred votes. And that is rife for problems counting. That is an invitation to fraud and hackers in this day and age. But if you looked at the national popular vote, there was actually 500,000 votes separating the candidates. And that was not a fluke. I've studied, and this is all in the book, the history of American elections is such that elections are rarely very close in the popular vote. And that is sort of just a mathematical truism that that's going to be the case because there are so many millions of votes. But in the Electoral College, you get several states in an election which are close, and now suddenly you have a potential chaos where we don't know who won. And as I said, that's an invitation to hackers and fraudsters of all kinds. They know they only have to monkey with the votes in one or two swing states, and there's a decent chance that they will change the outcome of the election. So I do call for abolishing the Electoral College. There are a lot of good reasons to do it, and this is one extra reason that no one has talked about.
Well, as much as the alleged involvement of Russia in manipulating the 2016 vote, Greg Palast, a journalist down in the States, has written for years about electoral gerrymandering and monkeying around, and he started with the 2000 elections and the whole idea of the machine voting and everything else. I mean, there are a host of problems, it seems, in this technological age, but there's also what Palast writes about is caging and purging and the problem of provisional ballots that are handed out to people that are deemed to be undesirable in certain districts, that the votes are never counted or at least counted only at the very end, if counted at all. I mean, there's a lot of issues here involved in the American system.
Absolutely. The scandal is what's legal to some extent, and some forms of voter suppression are legal, sadly. So yes, you're always going to run into those sorts of problems. And then there are all kinds of other problems which are unforeseen, except that actually we can foresee them. For example, what if there is a terrorist attack on election day or the day before that disables the voting machinery in some states? Even a natural disaster, a flood or a hurricane, may do that. Does the election proceed and certain states simply don't participate? And then, of course, now the virus is introducing a new set of problems. And then in 2000, interestingly enough, even without overt fraud, there was some of what Palast talks about for sure. But even if we throw that out, we had an election which was simply a tie. We just didn't know who won if you don't even count any fraud. So there are so many things that can go wrong, and we are guarding against more or less none of them.
Well, if you just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Alan Hirsch. Alan is an instructor in the humanities and chair of the Justice and Law Studies program at Williams College. He's author of numerous works of legal scholarship and many books, one of which we're talking about today, the newly released, A Short History of Presidential Election Crises and How to Prevent the Next One. Well, you say about the book, Alan, that you had three major reasons for taking this project on. It seems rather prescient to me, though, it coming as it did before this crisis in the making with the COVID, the COVID-19 pandemic. But can you tell me a little bit about some of these three circumstances of the American electoral status quo that urged you or prompted you rather to write this book now?
Well, number one is history suggests that we have a problem with elections. Number two is recent history. We have had two elections in the last five in which the person who received the most votes did not win. And number three, the most recent election we know was vulnerable to hackers, and we know that they're still out there gaining capability while we do very little to thwart them. So all of these circumstances conspired to make the timing of this book important. And on top of that, I mean, I simply enjoy the history aspect of it. And I hope people would find the book engaging history in its own right, because the elections of 1824, 1876, 2000, this is stuff you can't make up. This is stuff that is more entertaining and engaging than a political novel would be because of how bizarre it is. But it's not fun and games. I mean, it really is important that we get this right. Elections are the lifeblood of a democracy, and presidential elections are the most important of the elections. So it's stunning how short-sighted we have been in not taking the time and trouble to prevent the next crisis. And I'm trying to spur that kind of action.
Well, and you also write, and I was most amazed that even in the event, I mean, America, especially from this vantage point of Canada, we see it as a very litigious country, and very much the law plays a huge role in even daily life down there, it seems to me at least. But there is, in the case of an obviously flawed election, there is no provision within your Constitution to correct that situation, even after, as you mentioned, the historical precedent that you've experienced down there already.
Yeah, none whatsoever. I mean, I love the Constitution. It's wonderful in so many respects, and amendments have made it better and better over the centuries. But one of the defects in it is it says almost nothing about election administration, and therefore it's left to the states. And they have dropped the ball. And the tragic thing is that we have not responded to these crises. One time we did, and I think I indicated that at the outset, which is after the election of 1800, the 12th Amendment to the Constitution ensured that that mistake, the particular fiasco that happened in 1800, would not be repeated. But different fiascos have happened three times. No constitutional amendments have been passed. There have been tinkering around the edges with statutes. They have been completely inadequate. And sad to say, we are months away from what may be the next crisis. And I'll just add one thing. You're absolutely right. When we have a crisis, everyone rushes to the courts. And that's what happened in 2000. They went to the state courts. They went to federal courts. That is not the way to resolve an election crisis.
Well, it seems to me because in 2000, the Supreme Court essentially acted as the election board, or they verified it was up to the Supreme Court to decide who was going to be the president of the United States, essentially. Since that time, it seems to me at least that the placing judges on the Supreme Court has taken on a much more tantamount position in American life. Has the effect of the 2000 election politicized more the Supreme Court, or has it always been that way?
Well, all of the above. I mean, I think that people like myself who study constitutional law and the American judicial system historically always were aware that there was an element of politics in what the court does, but it was laid bare in the 2000 election. And I think it awakened our society to the extent to which politics pervades law. And even before then, Supreme Court nominations, that whole process was contaminated with politics. But it's grown even worse since then.
Well, Alan, you don't just write this book and then leave it off saying, well, we've got these problems and what are we going to do? You have a solution. You have remedies. You think that you have a way to prevent these things in the future. How do we do that?
So there's the short term and the long term, and I'll start with the latter. We should get rid of the Electoral College. Every single one of the election crises we have had, we had because of the Electoral College. If we simply had a national popular vote, the particular crises we've had would not have arisen. So that's number one. That's long term. That requires, it probably requires amending the Constitution. So that's not going to happen in time for this coming November. What I also propose, it could be done tomorrow to a large extent, is to create a permanent impartial commission, bipartisan, actually tripartisan, Democrats, Republicans, and people who belong to neither party, who would be empowered to and responsible for resolving any election crises. If necessary, they could move the election day, for example, if the virus is making the election impossible. They could call for a revote as a last resort if the election simply lacked legitimacy, if we couldn't figure out who won. They could hold hearings. They would have subpoena power. They could do whatever is necessary to get to the bottom of a controversy over the election. Because we've had so many controversies, we know more are coming. And we don't want it resolved the way it was in 2000, which is this complete ad hoc, chaotic race to the courts, and then resolved by what many people regard as a partisan court. So we ought to do some version of what I call a presidential election review board. And even though I'd like to see that put into the Constitution, so it would really be permanent and have full powers, that could be done by statute. And I'm trying to get people's attention between now and November. Obviously, they have their minds on other things. But, you know, we're always fighting the current war, and now it's the virus. So now the question is how to get voting by mail. But there are all these other problems which can arise as well, and we're simply not equipped to deal with them.
Well, in 2000, when Al Gore thought that he had lost this squeaker, he did the gentlemanly thing. He conceded graciously to George W. Bush. That seems like something so quaint. In fact, it might be part of the 19th century or even earlier in American history. But in 2016, Donald Trump intimated that he wouldn't accept a losing decision if he wasn't elected president. You mentioned there's a term in the book preamble, rather. You mentioned faithless electors, people who have lost faith in the system and having or lost faith in the results of an election. With so many people losing faith in the system generally, what do we stand risking here?
We're all concerned about what you describe. When I say we all, at least people who are not Trump supporters, are concerned that if Biden defeats Trump in November, Trump will not go quietly. He will scream fraud or fake news, fake election, we don't know what. So that is a real concern just layered upon all of the other concerns.
It's certainly interesting times. I appreciate you coming on today, Alan, and speaking with me. And I do hope that we get a chance to speak again, as we have months and months and months to go yet. And this does seem to be the most interesting American elections, perhaps.
Well, you know where to find me. I'd be glad to come on anytime.
Very gracious. Thanks a lot, Alan Hirsch.
Thank you, Chris.
This is David Rovics, and I will be listening to Guerrilla Radio in its new time slot at 1 p.m. on Wednesdays. I need to write this down. CFMU 101.9 in Victoria.
FM.
101.9 FM in Victoria.
Okay.
This is David Rovics, and I will be listening to Guerrilla Radio in its new time slot at 1 p.m. on Wednesdays on 101.9 FM CFUV in Victoria.
Listen to Guerrilla Radio every Thursday at 11 a.m. right here at CFUV. 101.9 FM in Victoria.
Hey, Chris. It's been a couple of weeks since we began the new reality, and I'm noticing that there are a few online events that I think people might be interested in. So the first one is something that I look forward to every day, is the 7 p.m. community applause for healthcare and other frontline workers. So there are, while we're at home, people are actually doing incredible things to keep our society going. The teachers went back this week. They're reinventing education in the schools that the custodians have cleansed thoroughly. So the teachers are I think the plan is to reach out to students from their classrooms, but in a virtual way. So they're joining, you know, all the other people who've been out there this whole time, the grocery store workers and the bus drivers and the recycling and garbage pickup people and, of course, the healthcare workers. So just acknowledging that while many of us are stuck inside our cages, we are able to open the window and make some noise at 7 o'clock every night. It's very fun and feels good. Okay. And apparently they really enjoy it. They appreciate knowing that we appreciate them. On April 8th, there's a webinar with Dr. Greger, who is an expert in infectious diseases and actually predicted this current situation way back in 2008, based on what has happened with animal agriculture and looking at other infectious diseases throughout the ages. So he is a best-selling author of How Not to Die. He's going to do a webinar on how not to die in a pandemic on April 8th. The last day to register is April 3rd. You can go to his website at nutritionfacts.org for more information to tune into that. Fridays for Future is still happening. Greta's creation in terms of awakening politicians and everybody else to the climate situation, which is something that we still have to do with. Although I saw a media report the other day that the ozone layer is looking better than it has for a long time, which is kind of interesting. I think the Earth is taking an extra long breath right now. But Fridays for Future is still happening, but from inside of our safe places. So she is suggesting we can, or they are suggesting we email politicians on Fridays, post on social media how we feel about climate change based on the science. Hashtag digital strike, hashtag silence strike, hashtag climate howl. Put a sign in your window with a photo, climate strike, Fridays for Future, online Zoom, and then think about other ways to be creative. So fridaysforfuture.org, that's a good thing to do tomorrow. Then this weekend, Saturday, actually starting tonight, and then also on Saturday, David Rovics, amazing activist musician, is going to be performing live via the technology. And at 5 o'clock tonight, a viral solidarity concert sponsored by Canada's National Union of Public and General Employees. And then April 4th, a show for the Belgian anarchists. So davidrovics.com or facebook.com, and then look up National Union of Public and General Employees. Get more information on that one. Folks on the autism spectrum are additionally challenged during these times, and there's an organization called Autistics United, and they have a support and advocacy program online. They have online hangouts. People can go and play board games and chat. Neurodivergent people, they say, Tuesdays and Saturdays. I think we all fall into that category at some place on the spectrum, quite frankly. Tuesdays and Saturdays, they'll be hosting online board games, watching videos, chatting, and sharing experiences. So it's on Facebook, Autistics United, if you want to get in on that. On Sundays from Salt Spring Island, virtual satsang, which is devotional singing in Sanskrit. Very powerful and calming. So on Facebook, look up virtual satsang to get involved with that one. Yara Willard is going to be offering herbal resilience workshops to do with mushrooms for resilience and immunity, herbs for immunity, elixirs and adaptogens. Now, Yarrow is one of the founders of Harmonic Arts, which are up island, and they produce these wonderful blends for us, and I'm very thankful that they exist on our island. So April 7th till 28th, there's going to be live stream series. If you go to their website, harmonicartslive.com, to learn about these amazing things that the plant kingdom, I don't like that word, kingdom, the plant world provides, and that is actually of use to keeping ourselves healthy. There is a live virtual program on ocean conservation from the Maritime Museum of BC. It's aimed towards, it's sort of a grade 2 science, but you know what? Having been in the schools, I can tell you that science has changed since we were there. So Tuesday, March 31st, oh, I guess that one's passed. Thursday, April 16th, there's going to be a show online or recorded after the facts, mmbc.bc.ca. about ocean conservation. And then, Chris, the Met Opera is presenting rebroadcasts of some of their great operas that they've hosted all the way into April. And if you go to metopera.org, if you're an opera fan, you can take part in enjoying that. And that's what I found for this week, Chris. If any of your listeners find any online virtual stuff that people you think would be interested in, please email me. My email address is anothervegan@shaw.ca. All right, thanks a lot, Chris.
Get messed up when the times get rough. Put your favorite record on, baby, and fill the bathtub up. You wanna say goodbye to your oldest friend. Good goddamn, with a good goddamn. Lay out your clothes, it's time to go. It's always dark as it's fourth dawn. The sun never shows. Say goodbye to your oldest friends. Maybe there's a good God damn. 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 Could it be a good God? Maybe there's a good God. Maybe there's a good God. Damn. this good God. Damn. Maybe there's a good God. Damn. Maybe there's a good God. If he made you.
Well, if you just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Taylor Scollin. Taylor is the publisher and co-founder of Passage. It's a new Canadian publication that, quote, offers left-wing perspectives on politics, economics, and culture. You write about the viability of socialism in our essentially capitalistic system. It seems that what we're getting right now in response to the COVID-19 pandemic crisis is, it looks an awful lot like socialism to me. It looks like these free enterprise corporations are coming to the government one at a time, asking for government help, if not oversight. Is this what are we getting a preview of what a socialized Canada might look like in the future?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of, you know, the old saying, there's no atheists in a foxhole. There's no capitalists in a global pandemic either, apparently. And I think that, you know, we are at a juncture where opportunities are opening up for people who, you know, share socialist perspectives to show the rest of the population why these are so essential. Because, you know, we've seen a total failure on the part of capitalist institutions to protect people at a very basic level from the health and, you know, economic impacts of this pandemic. I was just reading the other day that a ventilator company that was contracted by the American federal government years ago to produce a cheaper mobile ventilator was purchased by a larger manufacturer in order to prevent them from undercutting them in the market. And, you know, we're seeing right now that hospitals in New York City, and I'm sure in other cities in the near future, are not going to have the resources they need precisely because the capitalist institutions that we all know and love have failed to deliver the goods. So I think there is an opening for more socialist perspectives in this time, for sure.
Well, what's going on now has certainly showed up the gaps in our system in myriad ways. And as you write in your article about Canada's pension plan being proof of concept for socialism, some of the missteps, as you say, in the past are becoming glaringly apparent and to lethal effect. Amongst your articles at Passage, just before the COVID outbreak, you were writing about the Wet'suwet'en fight out here in British Columbia. This has been a very big deal. Can you tell me a little bit about how you think a different approach to the economics of this country would affect issues like First Nations, and especially where First Nations interests intersect with the so-called national interests of big energy?
Sure. So, I mean, I totally reject the idea that the interests of a few fossil fuel executives should be conflated with the national interest whatsoever. I mean, that's a parlor trick of conservative politicians for sure. But I really think that, you know, if you ask normal people, they don't often share the views of, you know, the CEO of these tar sands companies. But to your point, I mean, the problems that we saw with energy development in terms of the Wet'suwet'en fight, the problems that we see with these projects all the time are often rooted in the central problem with the capitalist system, which is that a very tiny number of people own most of the stuff. And as a consequence of that, they have all the power. And so we don't have the ability as communities or, you know, as a democracy to really exercise that control that we would like to over the direction of our economy. And I think part of the appeal of a socialist alternative is that it would give us broader control to make decisions as to how we want to prioritize the allocation of resources in our society. Do we really want to spend the next 10 years plowing more money into the oil industry when every scientist, most, in fact, international hedge funds, you know, agree that that's not a good use of resources. But because of the fact that these decisions are being made by a tiny number of people who control the wealth in this country, we actually have a difficult time shifting our direction.
Well, what about the argument, though, that there won't be any wealth in this country if we move to a socialist model, that the corporations and investment will disappear and the expertise needed to keep the economy buoyant, et cetera, will flee for its life and will be left unable to fund social programs because that we need capitalism to generate the wealth?
Yes, that's the argument that you often hear. You know, look at Venezuela and everything that's going on there. What I would say in response to that is, you know, we have plenty of real world examples of socialist institutions that work perfectly well. And, you know, I sort of wrote this article about Canada's pension plan to make that point, but we can look to other countries as well. You know, Norway is a leader in this regard. They, as a state, own about 75% of the non-household wealth in that country. So the wealth that's not tied up in people's homes is 75% of it is owned by the Norwegian government. That's far more than China. That's far more than really any other non-Nordic country on the planet. And I would argue that with the public, through their democratically elected government, owning 75% of the nation's wealth, we are verging into socialist territory. And Norway, you know, consistently ranks as one of the best countries in the world to live in, you know, happiest people, highest quality of life, one of the wealthiest countries. And that's because they made choices to build that sort of society. And I think that we can make similar choices and have the sort of outcomes in terms of quality of life that Nordic countries and Norway enjoy.
Well, a large part of the Norwegian prosperity was because of its offshore oil. Now, with the price of oil plummeting, both Norway's royalties from that and income from that are definitely going to be compromised, as is in Canada too. More than even a pandemic, when we see a whole resource industry tank the way that the oil sector has in this country, and I wonder how important the loss of that pillar of our economy is, as of the Canadian economy, or even how much of a pillar the oil industry is of the current Canadian economy. Do you know?
Well, I think it's a blow to our economy, largely because for the past several decades, we have really failed to invest the profits of that industry into developing our economy in other ways. So the Norwegian model, yes, was boosted in the early days by royalties and you know, direct revenue from oil sales, but they reinvested the profits of that into their social wealth funds, which now own, you know, assets around the world and domestically, which have nothing to do with oil. And in fact, they are divesting from fossil fuels in a major way. And we never did that. You know, we gave the oil companies in the oil sands a pretty sweet deal, and the Canadian public never really benefited from that. And, you know, today we see more news about Jason Kenney in Alberta talking about plowing more cash into the oil industry. And Canadians aren't going to benefit from that. Our economy isn't going to benefit from that. The people who are going to benefit from that are the shareholders of these fossil fuel corporations, who are predominantly already very wealthy individuals. So, I mean, we can't discount the fact that losing the oil industry, you know, oil, I think, is at $3.50 a barrel today. That's a problem that we have to deal with, but we can't deal with it in the way that we've traditionally done, which is by just throwing more money at oil corporations. We need to shift the direction of our economy away from that sector.
Well, you're right in stating that the Norwegians did it well. They vertically integrated their whole oil industry, which is something that Canada certainly should have done, but failed to do for a variety of reasons. Now we find ourselves in the pickle that we are. So I guess looking back, it's not entirely helpful. But you've written another piece about the federal government response to the COVID-19. All these people are out of work now. I mean, as everybody knows. Your article, How to Fix Trudeau's Plan to Help Workers During COVID-19. What do you see that is lacking in, so far at least, in the federal government's response, economic response, to this sudden thrusting of millions of Canadians out of work?
Yeah, so I think the biggest problem right now is with the design of the Canada Emergency Response Benefit. So that was announced late last week and was sort of an improvement on what they had initially announced, which were these two separate benefits, very confusing as to who qualified for which. And I think they heard the criticism of that and changed course to this emergency response benefit, the CERB. The problem with the CERB is that it leaves behind several large groups of people who really do need financial support right now. And it does that because its eligibility criteria is, I would say, overly complicated and overly restricted. So, for example, to qualify for the CERB, which, just so your audience knows, is a $2,000 a month payment for people who have lost their income due to COVID-19. But to qualify for that benefit, you need to have earned at least $5,000 in 2019 or in the past 12-month period. Now, recent graduates from university or college, or people who graduated last year and are still trying to get into the job market, they're not going to have, in a lot of cases, that $5,000 of past earnings. And so they're not going to qualify, but they're also not going to be able to get work because, obviously, given the circumstances we're in, people aren't hiring right now. So that's one entire group of people which is just not going to benefit from this at all. And a lot of them really do need financial support right now. And there's other classes of people too who are going to be excluded from this because of the eligibility criteria. You know, gig workers who are doing a little bit of work but haven't lost their income altogether, they would not qualify. You have to have no income whatsoever. People who are self-employed but have not lost all their income, have just lost, 75% of it, they also would not qualify. So, I mean, my recommendation was that the government should ease these eligibility restrictions and expand it to far more people. I mean, in an ideal world, I think we would have just sort of a universal cash transfer to people to get them through this time. But if that's not a concept that they're willing to contemplate for whatever reason, then I think there are improvements that can be made to the CERB approach.
How about something along the lines of the basic income, the guaranteed basic income?
Yeah, no, I think that would be the optimal way to do it. It's simple, fast, just get cash in people's hands as quickly as possible. And I think that's probably what's needed. I hope that's the direction they go in. I'm not sure it will be.
Well, ironically enough, though, the workers that would administer this plan of Mr. Trudeau and the Liberal government, they walked off the job themselves, worried about their own health and also the throngs of people trying to get in the doors at employment insurance to make claims. They just couldn't handle it. The stress was too much. So now even getting through to file claims seems to be a huge challenge.
Yeah, and I mean, in any sort of program where you have means testing, application process, evaluations, that sort of thing, you're going to have these administrative problems. And, I have some sympathy for the people who are designing these policies because they're kind of trying to construct a functional welfare state on the fly when it's been eroded over 20, 30, 40 years by a succession of conservative and liberal governments. to the point where we really have no slack in the system, and a lot of the programs that should be there to support people and absorb the problems that people are experiencing right now because of this crisis just don't exist. And trying to construct that in the middle of an emergency, I have sympathy for how difficult that must be, but there's a lot of people who are really struggling right now, and I think the approach needs to be more robust than it has been.
Well, I was kind of cheeky off the top, Taylor, in talking about online journalism but sincere about the blizzard of news and the difficulty for everyday people to really discern what's going on, what's really going on, and also to shield themselves from the great mass, the blizzard of it all. But you at Passages, you've gone into this maelstrom, as I describe it. Tell me a little bit about the founding of your publishing effort, Passage Online.
Sure. I mean, we were sort of frustrated with the way that the mainstream media, the corporate media, operates in Canada. I think outside of a few notable exceptions, Narwhal, Taï, Ricochet, it's hard to find real independent left-wing analysis of the big issues that we're facing in this country. And I think that there was a gap there that we wanted to fill. And, you know, we launched Passage in February, and we've published around 40 original essays so far. I'm really happy with what we've been able to put out. We have a lot of really smart and talented writers in this country on the left. And I think it's really important that we get their perspectives and their voices in front of more people. I mean, there's an exciting, I think, left-wing media ecosystem developing in the United States with, Jacobin, The Intercept, these places. In the UK, there's outlets there that are doing similar things. And we want to be a part of, generating that sort of ecosystem here in Canada.
Well, and the site you can find at readpassage.com, R-E-A-D, readpassage.com. Well, I mean, before, it seems that, well, obviously the COVID-19 story has blown everything out of the water news-wise, but the news still spins on. But just before this latest disaster occurred, it seemed that the idea of socializing the economy in North America, especially with Bernie Sanders running for president, at least the nomination of the Democratic Party to run for president down in the States, the idea of socializing the economy, or at least here, was getting a lot of traction. It now seems to be blown out of the water. What's your take on what's happening south of us? And is that the kind of socialism that you would like to see up here, or that you think might be able to be a leading light for Canadian politicians?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, Bernie is an inspirational figure and what he's been able to do down there. I mean, if you look at what politics was like in the U.S. in, 2012, 2008, the mention of the word socialism was totally taboo. The ideas that Bernie has brought into the mainstream were totally excluded from the national conversation. And I think that is a real achievement, even though, apparently he is not going to win the nomination. At least that's the way it looks right now, although who knows what's going on with the delays in the voting because of the crisis. I guess it's really hard to say how that's going to shake out. But, I think that we have a lot to learn from the way that he communicated about socialist ideas in a way that, ordinary people, the general public understood and believed in. He knew how to tap into public perceptions about how the world works and tie that to a real left-wing agenda. Now, I think a lot of what he centered in his campaign was sort of run-of-the-mill social democratic stuff, because that's where America is right now. But if you dig a little deeper behind the universal health care, that sort of thing, there is elements there of a more radical agenda that I think are worth noting. You know, for example, Bernie had in his platform a proposal for worker ownership funds, sort of similar to what I had laid out in the pension plan piece, but that would, you know, over time bring large swaths of the economy under the ownership of workers. And he didn't talk about that a lot, but it was there. And I think that, you know, it's pretty inspiring that we got a candidate in the United States, which is, you know, sort of the heart of capitalism, pretty close to the presidency, who believed in those things and had the will to campaign on them. So I think we have a lot to learn from that. And I'd love to see more candidates here talking about politics in the way that Bernie did.
Well, Canada, we've been a little more on the left spectrum. I think some people in the States would say we're socialists up here already. But one source of frustration for me, at least, is, has been the left's failure to embrace a different foreign policy agenda than on the right, whether it's in Canada or the United States. You see policies towards wars in the Middle East and support of Israel's policies in Palestine. There doesn't seem to be a great difference between the two. And in the press here, it seems even less so. Do you find a place for Passage to fill that gap as well in dealing with Canada abroad as well as at home?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've published a number of pieces on foreign policy so far that I think it's safe to say you wouldn't read in any mainstream publication in Canada. You know, we published an essay a couple of weeks ago arguing that the government should drop sanctions on North Korea, which I think is a correct view, but one that you certainly won't read in the Globe and Mail or the Toronto Star or what have you. And you're totally right. The foreign policy conversation in this country, particularly in the media, is so myopic and really lacks any sort of nuance or, in a lot of cases, depth of understanding of the issues. I mean, I am not an expert in foreign policy, but I have, you know, principles, as I'm sure you do, that I think are important to keep in mind. And I, you know, we saw a perfect example of how you know, our country's institutions respond abroad with the coup in Bolivia just a couple months ago. You know, which I saw that people on the left, outside of mainstream politics, were, you know, saying that this is a coup, this is going to be a disaster. You know, Evo Morales was a democratically elected leader, and every establishment institution in this country said that he had to go. And, you know, lo and behold, a couple of months later, we see reports that the election, his reelection, was in fact conducted fairly. And, you know, the people who have organized that coup and are now in charge are committing human rights abuses. And this is how this plays out again and again and again. It's so predictable, but we never hear a peep of criticism about that in the mainstream press. And I think that's really telling.
Well, I would venture it was even obvious. It was obvious from the start, and Canada's support on both sides of the aisle for the overthrow of the government in Honduras in 2009, and the repeated attempts to overthrow the government in Venezuela. I mean, it's and of course Haiti before that. It goes on and on, as you say. But I think a lot of Canadians aren't even aware that Canada has a sanctions policy similar to the Americans, and in some instances, like in Venezuela, even more robust. Taylor, I think you and Passage have your work cut out for you. There's so much that needs being done, and I certainly applaud your efforts, and I hope that you guys forge ahead and grow and grow and grow.
Well, I appreciate that. Thanks a lot for having me, and it was good chatting with you.
Well, and thanks for coming on, and I want to also thank Alan Hirsch and Janine Bancroft and all the good folks up here that keep the wheels spinning week in and week out. There's great programming coming up, you know that, but till the next time, that's all I have. Thanks again to you. Maybe there's a good God. Damn.